Thank you for coming. It's a delight to see everybody here. This began as a suggestion to Rachel in the department that I might do a small intimate lecture in the department as a valedictory lecture, just to round things out, as it were. It's ended up by having a kind of impetus of its own, which certainly is not my doing, and it's ended up by looking like rather a grand finale of self-advertisement, which is definitely not intended to be. Anyway, how the idea was to do something rather intimate, how many numbers you have to get up to before it ceases to be intimate, I don't know, but certainly this seems to be exceeding it somewhat. When I devised the title of the lecture, I said it's just a valedictory, and I hadn't got any idea what I might do other than, you know, I've been in the business for 40 years, just looking back on that in some shape or form, and I'm glad I didn't give a title to it, because up until 4 days ago, I was going to do it not exactly chronologically, but taking the four big blocks of time I've spent in different places, which marked phases of my career. They are blocks of 14, 15 years each. The first job was in Dalhousie in the Maritimes. I was part of Anthony Blunt's placement agency, the all English-speaking placement agency that Anthony Blunt ran with his customary inscrutability. And then 1965 to 1966 to 81, I was a lecturer in Glasgow. It's a sign of how professional prospects in any subject, academic subject, have changed that I was in a tenured post when I was 24 years old. That wasn't particularly, I was particularly clever, but we've overseen between us and the authorities and all the education authorities and so on an enormous deterioration in that sense that really well-trained people ought to get into decent careers at a decent time of life, but there we are. 1966 to 81, there was that was the block in Glasgow. 1981 to 1995 was professor in St Andrews, and then henceforth here. So there are these three big symmetrical blocks. But I decided not to follow those, because when I started looking at what I did in Glasgow, it seemed that virtually everything I've subsequently done was foreshadowed in some way, and it seemed rather more sensible to order it by some big themes. I also had intended to plot what I've done against the development in the subject, old art history, connoisseurship, etc., new art history, but I found that what I'd been doing over the years didn't map onto that at all, and indeed somehow isn't quite identified as old art history and is not identified as new art history either, so I also abandoned that comparative approach. So what I'm going to do is to look at some big continuous themes, well, whether they're big themes you can judge, but themes which have been big for me over the period of time. And not on the whole looking at the orthodox art history I've done, which has more or less meant that I've kept enough orthodox art history to be going to be legitimately called a professor of the history of art rather than something else. The blocks are, unsurprisingly, Leonardo, first of all. Secondly is bodies. Leonardo, I should also look in passing at scientific examination of paintings, which is something which has greatly concerned me over the years. Second one is bodies, from anatomy to sex. The third one is optics, from Brunelleschi to Hockney. The fourth is other sciences, through the column I write in Nature, the science magazine. The fifth is modelling, physical modelling, computer modelling, things which are in the business of public communication, but involve serious research. You can't present something in public without difficult questions being asked of the material. And some concluding remarks on whether there's any demonstrable centre to all this activity. The beginning point, actually, I do begin in a sort of chronological way, leaving aside some inconsequential bits and pieces I'd written in an art history first, was this is how I got into the slightly strange visual imaging business, the business of visual history. And it was via a television program, or a television program that wasn't to be transmitted. a young BBC trainee television producer had to do a program, a diploma program, which wasn't going to be transmitted. He'd obviously gone to the right people. He'd gone to Gombrich, probably John Shearman, who I studied with at the Courtauld, and they weren't going to waste their time with a program that wasn't going to be transmitted. Anyway, eventually it got down to me, and I was happy to waste my time on this. But he decided to do this television program on Leonardo's water drawings. Very odd choice. But the consequence of this is that Gombrich gave him a then unpublished paper, subsequently published, on Leonardo's water drawings, and that came to me. And Gombrich looked at these kinds of drawings by Leonardo and said they're not miraculous snapshots, but they embed a lot of theoretical notions. They're synthetic demonstrations, dimostrazioni, as Leonardo would call them, of the anatomy of the water flow, but based both upon obviously scrupulous observation, but also upon a theoretical organizing of those, and pointed out that if you looked at Aristotle's dynamics, which are very different from Newton, the Aristotle dynamics are predicated on the fact that if something moves, it has a set performance and it will stop. Newtonian dynamics assume that something stays in the state it is unless contrary forces impinge upon it and ultimately prevail. And that sort of got me thinking in a way about Leonardo. As a postgraduate student, I'd avoided Leonardo. He looked big and difficult. I also avoided perspective as a graduate student, which looked big and difficult, and they're two of the things I subsequently spent most time doing. But that rang a bell, and the approach of thinking about how theory directs observation. As someone trained in natural sciences, I had a very strong sense of how much what you're looking for affects the observation and the representation. I didn't, however, work on the water drawings. I did so later and found out that Ernst, who is a wonderful scholar, had actually more or less ignored all the medieval impetus dynamics, which are actually Leonardo's source. He went straight to Aristotle rather than through the Middle Ages, the medieval sources available to Leonardo. But the mode of analysis was absolutely key for me, regardless of the fact that I realized to some extent he was looking in the wrong place. But what I engaged with were the anatomical drawings, and sat for evenings in Glasgow going systematically through all the Leonardo anatomical drawings, and then going back to Windsor to look at the original. Windsor was my hometown, so it's slightly odd, and being interviewed by the librarian Mackworth Young to see if I was a fit person to be given access to this very precious material. And I got particularly interested in the skull drawings from 1489, this group of drawings, which on one hand are obviously miraculous bits of early scientific naturalism. The vertical section in the top left there with the sinus, you don't get that out of books. This is an original observation. But at the same time, Leonardo is producing these very synthetic diagrams of the ventricular system. The system of thought was then thought to occur within the spaces, the cavities of the brain, an absolutely standard medieval device. But these drawings actually serve the same purpose, because the center of gravity, the literal proportional center of gravity of the skull here, the sensus communis, the common sense into which the sensory impressions pour to be compared and judged, this is at the geometrical center of this system. So these two diagrams are greatly linked. Looking into this system of faculty psychology, as it's called, because you have different faculties in the different ventricles. Let's go down here. He located the imprensiva here, the senso comuni, the common sense here, with intellect and fantasia and voluntary motion and memory in the last storage flask at the back. And looking at this, it seemed vital for his notion of creativity, his notion of fantasia, very Dantesque word, as he very well knew himself, the imaginative ability to recombine elements from nature, and that understanding the faculty psychology keyed both back into Dante and also into Leonardo's notions about the remaking of nature in works of art. And in terms of a whole series of things, the brain as conceived by Leonardo seemed to hold a key to many of the things that were going on in his art, particularly the system of expression, what he called il concetto dell'anima, the concept or purpose of the mind, which was transmitted from the brain through this system of neurological plumbing. This is deliberately a schematized version of it. He writes, questo dimostrazione, this demonstration is as necessary to good draftsmen as is the scansion of Latin for good grammarians. And this is the system of nervous plumbing, which means that as soon as Christ says one of you will betray me, there is this surge of nervous activity through the medulla, the hollow core of these nerves, and the figures all react inevitably and spontaneously in this. So that's why this demonstration is, which looks to us not very useful for artists, is necessary for good grammarians. And of course there's all the optical material, the eye as the at the center of this system, the eye with its spherical lens plugged more directly into the ventricular system than any of the other features, both for the perspective of course, but also for such things as the relative intensity of light on a head. And I'll come back to that briefly when we talk about ray tracing later in the lecture. But that resulted in the first sort of articles, which I would have some sense that they were the start of my career rather than the sort of the more orthodox art historical things I'd been doing to that point. And as I worked through the anatomies, so these other big themes arose, particularly the one of the microcosm. The idea that the human body in miniature is, as Leonardo put it, a lesser world, an ancient idea going back indeed to the ancients and well known in the Middle Ages, that the body itself effectively has a reflection in it or is a mirror of the greater universal structure, the laws, the forms and so on. Symbolized here rather neatly in both the Mona Lisa, but obviously with the here the vascular system, based upon the dissection of a 100-year-old man that he performed in the winter of 1507-1508, compared to a nocciolo, a nut or a germinating peach stone, say, and the heart. This was all part of the debate between Galen and Aristotle, ultimately, this rumbled on, as to whether the heart or the liver was the origin of the vascular system. Leonardo points out, with the pungent directness of language he so often used in these things, that the vessels of the liver are rooted in the dung of the liver, like the vessels are rooted in like the roots are rooted in the ground, and therefore the heart is the seed, the nocciolo, and therefore the origins of the vascular system. For him, this argument for analogy was not merely convenient. Because the microcosm held good, it was a form of proof. Analogy in this point had a quite different status from the way that scientists now use analogy, which is as a way of creative thinking or aligning something with something else, but it doesn't have this fundamental depth. The two other images here, the image of the Arno Canal arching from Florence up in this big loop following the line of the A9 Autostrada, to get past the non-navigable bit of the Arno, this wonderful map, a living body of the earth. The whole earth stirs even in a map, but it's got a scale on it, so it's a real map. Given that sense of life, and here an unusual drawing of the Munione and Arno near Florence. Very vascular, isn't it? It looks very like a sort of vascular system in a way. And he called these vene d'acqua, veins of water, or vessels of water, but there's no clear distinction between veins and arteries in the way in which his vocabulary works. It's also labelled It's also labelled left to right, so someone else is obviously meant to read that one. It's some draft report or something which is actually handed over. The microcosm is basically a qualitative thing. It's not modern science in that sense. It tells you the type of thing you're dealing with. But he also did attempt to apply quantification in a very unusual way to organic features. If we look, for instance, at two branching systems, you have the bronchi, this wonderful coralline image of the bronchi and the lungs on the left, and a tree on the right. And he explains that a branching system, in order to have non-turbulent flow, to summarize it in modern language, that at each point in the system the total cross-sectional area should be equal if you're to get regular flow. It's a law which was stated somewhat differently by Boyle in the 17th century. But therefore, a tree, it doesn't look absolutely regular, but the basic principle of tree branching is that at each of these layers, the cross-sectional areas, if you add them up, should be equal to the main trunk and equal to each other at that particular layer. The bronchi bifurcate with obviously an extraordinary regularity. Trees clearly don't, and indeed the bronchi don't do it in quite that wonderful geometric way, but this is a dimostrazione. You should always remember that. These are not dissection drawings in that sense. They're syntheses, to go back to Gombrich, of form and function based upon observation and theory. Looking always across, Leonardo had analogy or had comparative visions to an almost pathological degree. He couldn't look at anything without seeing something else. Typically here in this note, he says, "Nota how the movement of hair, the movement of water resembles that of hair, with the weight of the hair equaling the impeto, the movement of the current, and the tendency of hair to curl equaling the tendency of water within water to revolve, and therefore to adopt this this helical pattern." It was this particular vision that I worked on when I did a CD-ROM for Bill Gates when he acquired the Leicester Codex. And I found one of my old sketches, which was in the initial conception of the CD-ROM. When I showed them a developed version of this, the designers said, "You've done my job for me." This proved not to be quite the case. But what I thought was to have a system of roots which were fundamental concepts like geometry, light, the basic kind of abstract things, the powers of nature and so on, moving up through the trunk concepts, which was there's four elements there. There's the fetus here, this is symbolizing life, and there's a Vitruvian man there. And then branching up into all the areas of applied things, like I can't read this handwriting at all, it's absolutely appalling, but into painting, architecture, physics, all the practical applications, as it were. The final CD-ROM, we kept the trunk and the branches, but the roots went, because the people working on it said they thought it was too complicated for people to grasp the difference between the abstract principles and the expressions in practical form. Now, not being rude about that, that's a real decision, and they may well have been right. The CD came out, and very interestingly, I picked up the CD. I've got a Mac version and a PC version, and neither of them will run on modern computers. 1989, early 1990s. Just astonishing. And you think that all this electronic stuff which we're producing, in a sense, can't be archived very regularly, or if it can, we're not necessarily going to be able to read it. So the more you work with the new technologies, and I'm a techno lover, I mean, I absolutely love this stuff, but it's interesting, isn't it? The book can become rare, but at least you can still turn the pages and read it. I can no longer turn the pages, as it were, and read that. Cheryl Besnark, our computer guru in the history faculty, is working on it, but we will see. It did some rather nice things, in fact, and this is about the best I can do. This is the back cover of the box. We invented something called a codascope, where you could move this thing over a page of Leonardo and you could get the Italian writing flipped, you could get it transcribed, you could get it translated, and you can move it over. And I can assure you, to fit translation of Italian same size into a window is not a simple job. The works of art and drawings were all exhibited within the circular temple, the circular church, and you went round the circular church exploring all this. And inside the main one, we had a lot of very fancy recreation of Leonardo experiments, computer graphics and so on, none of which I can show you, but this lecture is going to be too long anyway, so it's probably a good thing that I haven't also got this to spend time doing. Just to give one example of how getting into an area of Leonardo which seems quite small can get you into lots of other areas. And I'm taking the heart in this case, these remarkable late studies of ox hearts. I'm sorry, the screen is flickering, which probably isn't, it's okay on my computer. These amazing drawings of ox hearts, which Francis Wells of Papworth is currently writing about and has actually dissected an ox heart, and particularly the valves, the three cusp valves, which Leonardo became hugely interested in. Here they are in isolation, and thought about the vortices that operate within the valves, within the constrained neck of the aorta, as the blood comes out. So these valves are passive, they have no muscular or tendinous action, and he's thinking about, though he could never see this of course, but he's bringing his understanding of water in other motions, this is pouring through two weirs here, he's bringing that understanding to the plotting by visualization, not by vision, how the vortices might be working inside the valve. And in the V&A, working with Francis Wells, this was one of the animations we did. The heart works like a wringing out towel. The reason it's so powerful is it does that. It doesn't do that. So this is all based upon real knowledge. Keep your eye upon the little fellows on the right-hand page, eventually. These were done by Steve Maher, who worked for Cosgrove Hall, now set up his own independent company, which has now been taken over. This is done with wonderful sensitivity, and we spent a lot of time tuning the colour of the paper, the transparency of the ink, etc. That saves a lot of label writing, I can assure you. Another dimension of Leonardo, which gives me a chance at least to introduce something I've been enormously interested in over the years, scientific examination of paintings using x-rays. And I started that in Glasgow with the Hunterian Chardins, which we took down to the Western Infirmary, and the corpse moved over and the painting went on. And it did perfectly good x-rays. This is a particular case in point. The two versions of the Leonardo Madonna of the Armwinder, documented as begun in 1501, and these two versions were normally said to be very good studio products, with a lost original. When we examined them with infrared, and this is curtailing the story greatly, we found underneath these similar but not identical preliminary drawings going on in the panel. An arch structure here, there's actually something I call a baby walker group here, which is visible in other paintings. You won't be able to see that here, but it's there. Something of the same things here. The cross has been moved. There's been an enormous amount of changes going on, first in one picture, then in another picture, and you can almost plot the changes, which one gets in advance of the other as a drawing. So there ain't no lost original. These are both things produced in the studio side by side by Leonardo and the lads. Some of it's beautifully painted, some of it's more routinely painted, particularly the landscape in the painting on the left. And one of the things I'm arguing is that this technical branch of art history is not separate from social art history. This is about the production of artifacts, and unless we know through all the techniques available to us what the production of artefacts are, we're very ill placed to say anything about their social history at all. So these are not separate branches. One doesn't live in a museum in the basement of the technical one, and another one live in academia. They tend to do that these days, but there's absolutely no intellectual justification for them doing so. It's also worth saying that Leonardo takes you into odd places, and in this case it's taken me recently to back up to Scotland to inspect this painting when it reappeared after its theft, and to say to the police, yes, this is the original painting, because obviously a lot rests on this. And with policemen taking endless statements for me, I thought maybe I was an Aguido or whatever it's called at one point, but this proves happily not to be the case. But fortunately, this painting, the Baclumadonna, which was stolen in 2003, and was recovered from a Glasgow lawyer's office just recently. These infrareds, these are more recent ones, but we got infrareds which hadn't been published. So the police were delighted, because this is real forensics. I was able to say to them, this doesn't just look like the original painting, but no forger would know this underdrawing, which we hadn't at that stage published. So the police were absolutely delighted that it was a foolproof method. As I say, Leonardo gets you into very, very odd places. The image on the right I won't comment on, other than to credit Rowan Drury, member of the Universal Leonardo team, for it. But on the left, this is the Sunday Sport. I hasten to add that a student gave me this with it duly ringed. The story was that the Mona Lisa, the reason she smiled with her mouth closed was because she'd had mercury treatment for syphilis and her teeth had gone black. Hence the story here. They phoned me up. Well, which other artist would get on page 3 of the Sunday Sport? It's astonishing. Leonardo is just remarkable. Michelangelo might creep in on a slack day, but it is absolutely formidable. Anyway, there's me quoted in the Sunday Sport. I've also been on page 3 of the Sun, which quoted, I have to say. Even the Universal Leonardo and relatively more serious things get you into some funny scrapes as well. This was an absolutely top photographer, Mark Stein, for one of the great German photographic picture magazines, and it won prize in a competition of science photography. But this is the Universal Leonardo, the big Europe-wide enterprise I set up with Marina Wallace. Marina is duly there, looking unduly cheerful in the Last Supper, I think, but that may be because she was brought up as an Italian Catholic. Teresa Wells, who's actually married Francis Wells, who works on the heart. You never know what's going to happen with Leonardo, even marriage agencies come along. But this, believe it or not, was a set of 4 single-take photographs. That's all he did. And he said, do you not want to take more shots? He said, no, it will be good. And it was good. Leonardo also, you get this continual stories and things coming up. This lecture is going to go on much longer than it should. Anyway, I'll speed up at some point. Just some examples. Some of you may recently have caught up with the discovery of this Luca Pacioli manuscript on chess, which was known through printed versions, but the original manuscript. Aha, people say, this must be Leonardo's drawings. And it was published as such and created a lot of attention, and Ray Keane in the Times wrote quite a long piece in it. I'm in touch with him. I pointed out that the grids are certainly drawn by a right-hander, and you can always tell that, and indeed the drawing of these things is not very good. So the response then is, oh well, he designed them even if he didn't draw them. This is the kind of argument you get in the Leonardo area, where any system of argument actually gets lost. Endless speculative Leonardos. The one on the right is actually one of the better pictures. It's a peculiar collage of Raphael, sub-Leonardos and other High Renaissance images, but it seems to be okay in date. and it's a very puzzling object. I get lots of these, including absolutely dreadful Leonardo versions which purport to be the original of the Mona Lisa or whatever. And recently a clutch of forgeries. Very good, very clever forgeries, of which this is one. This was discovered in Dundee in the book conservation studios, and Dundee University have one of the leading historic book conservation studios. And a person had sent this book in, it's an 18th century French book, saying there's some lump, something in the end papers, can you have a look also while you're rebinding it? And from this 18th century book, out come these two drawings, which if they're from the, got back to the 18th century, they must be Leonardo, more or less, because nobody knew these kind of drawings. These are from the Codex Madrid style drawings, from which were rediscovered in 1966, but they're forgeries. Very, very good. And somebody who knows a hell of a lot about Leonardo has been involved in these, which bears a bit of thinking about. But there's a whole series of reasons. Initially, I thought, wow, this is really good. But those capstans, for instance, are absolutely not Leonardo. There's an axle there that would collapse under the first sign of pressure, etc., etc. So it's a good try. Amazingly good try. And even the language is absolutely Leonardesque. But this is a kind of continual public activity which is sort of going on through emails, correspondence and so on, to say nothing of the Leonardo Lunis, who draw masses of geometry on the surface of Leonardo paintings and align them with the Knight Templars or whoever happens to be the flavour of the month.